from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here this week for Michael Krasny. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court wraps up its term with a long-awaited decision on affirmative action. In a 5-4 decision, the justices overturned an earlier ruling from a federal appeals court panel that included Judge Sonia Sotomayor, President Obama's nominee for the High Court. Coming up, we'll analyze today's affirmative action ruling to hear what impact it could have on hiring practices across the nation and discuss how it could affect Sotomayor's confirmation hearings next month. The Supreme Court's term-ending decisions, that's our topic this hour. We'll take your phone calls and email, and we'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. Well, as we've been hearing this morning, the U.S. Supreme Court ended its current term today with a high-profile ruling on affirmative action. In a decision written by Justice Anthony Kennedy, the court sided with white firefighters in New Haven, Connecticut, saying the city unfairly scrapped a promotion exam because no minority firefighters did well enough to likely be elevated to lieutenant or captain. The 5-4 ruling reverses an earlier decision endorsed by Sonia Sotomayor as a member of the 2nd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. She, of course, is President Obama's nominee for the Supreme Court to replace retiring Justice David Souter. We've got a panel of legal experts to talk about that. And first, Willow, we want to go to Washington, D.C., where Lawrence Hurley of the Daily Journal is standing by. Lawrence Hurley, good to have you with us.
How are you doing?
And thank you. And you were in the courtroom this morning, and of course, some history made in the sense that this was the last day for Justice David Souter. Tell us about the mood in the courtroom and what happened.
Yeah, that's right. Well, actually, it was quite interesting because the Chief Justice and Justice Souter both kind of exchanged love letters, if you like. Chief Justice Roberts said, "We note with sadness this is our last session in which our friend and colleague Justice David Souter will be on the bench with us." And then he read a letter that he wrote to Justice Souter. And then Justice Souter responded by reading his own letter, where he said that the Chief Justice's generous letter has touched me more than I can say.
Interesting phrase. What did he seem genuinely saddened by this final day, or elated, or relieved? I mean, Souter has been long rumored to want off that court.
Yeah, I mean, I think those familiar with him will know that it's pretty hard to tell what he's thinking at any time. So I think his letter shows that, he obviously valued his time on the court, but he's equally glad to be heading back to New Hampshire.
And were there any other words from his other fellow justices?
Not today, no, but they all signed on to the Chief Justice's letter.
And he is actually stepping down as of today, right? He is not going to stick around for this confirmation hearing.
That's right, yeah.
And does that have any significance legally, or is it just a sort of an unusual historical quirk?
I think the court can operate, if necessary, without the full complement of justices. So even if something went wrong with the confirmation, I don't think it would be a problem.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Lawrence Hurley, for joining us this morning from Washington, Daily Journal reporter covering the Supreme Court. And with me here in the studio this morning, Rory Little. He's a professor of law at Hastings College of the Law here in San Francisco. Good morning to you.
Morning.
Also joining us by phone from Chicago, Richard Epstein, senior fellow with the Hoover Institution. He's a professor at the University of Chicago and also a visiting professor of law at NYU. Good morning to you.
Nice to be here.
And also with us, Deborah Rohde. She's director of the Center on the Legal Profession at Stanford Law School. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, let me begin with you, Professor Little, if I may. Tell us about this New Haven decision. What exactly were the justices looking at?
Well, it's an interesting decision, mainly because the nominee Sotomayor is the underlying judge from the Second Circuit. But it's a pretty important, I think, Title VII case involving, this controversy where you give a test designed to determine who should become a firefighter. And it turns out lots of people passed, but all the people at the top were white. And the people who were African-American weren't going to get any promotions. So then what do you do? And the city of New Haven says, gee, we're going to get sued if we go forward.
Sued by minority firefighters, presumably?
Yeah, and we're going to get sued if we don't. I mean, it's sort of like, which way do we go? The Supreme Court, I think, cleared up some they made some law here. I mean, this was not a case that the lower courts would have necessarily predicted. They made some law here about how a disparate impact suit and a disparate treatment suit, how they're going to interact. Justice Scalia actually writes a concurring opinion today saying, I don't even know if Title VII is constitutional. I think maybe there's a constitutional problem here.
And tell us what Title VII is.
Title VII is the law that Congress has enacted to, if you will, address employment discrimination in many different ways. And so you can sue if there's an impact. It doesn't have to be intentional. That has a minority effect. And so the question here is, which way was the city going to go? They abandoned the test results, and they were sued in this lawsuit, and the Supreme Court has decided 5-4 that this suit should have come out against the city.
Now, of course, the trial court and then the appellate, a panel of appeals judges, including Sotomayor, sided with the city. So this reverses those lower court rulings.
It does reverse the lower court rulings. The most interesting thing about the lower court was that when the Second Circuit panel of three judges decided the case, there was a petition for the entire Second Circuit to hear it, an en banc proceeding. And they did not grant en banc, but just Judge Cabranes, who is Latino himself.
And a mentor, former mentor of Sotomayor.
A mentor of Sotomayor in some sense, dissented and said, you all are burying a very difficult issue here and you shouldn't do that.
It was a rather bitter dissent.
Yeah, it was sort of an amazing thing. And of course, he had no idea at the time, I think, that Sonia Sotomayor was going to be nominated.
And Richard Epstein, as you look at the ruling, and I don't know if you've had a chance to read it all. It just came out It just came out about an hour and a half, 2 hours ago. But based on what you've heard, what you know, what's the significance? What exactly did Justice Kennedy say in this ruling today?
Well, I mean, basically what he did is he tracked the statute as it was modified in 1989. And the way in which the thing plays out is that the current law requires, first, that you show that there be a disparate impact on the test to create a prima facie case for the firefighter.
All right, and tell us what disparate case means, because not all of us
have legal degrees.
A disparate
impact case means what happens is you ignore any intent to create some kind of an imbalance based upon race. It's not a form of intentional segregation. But if you look at the outcome, what you discover is that things are not perfectly in line. As was mentioned earlier by Professor Little, it's a situation in which all the white test takers tended to be at the top of the list and the black ones at the bottom. And the theory is that if there's more than 80% disparity in these outcomes under the kind of current wisdom, the test is presumptively invalid unless you can show that it's been justified. How do you justify it? You have to show that there's some kind of a business necessity in order to use the test. And then after you show that, the firefighters who are attacking the test could come back in a three-part arrangement. And what they're entitled to do is to say, look, you could have gotten the same kind of business purpose satisfied by using a different scheme which did not involve any kind of a discriminatory impact. So it's a three-stage process. First, you show disparate impact. Then you show business necessity by the defendant. Then the plaintiff shows alternative means. And this has been pretty settled in discrimination law in the United States now for at least 20 years. And the question was, how does that framework play out? The court's basic position was, we concede, everybody does, that there was a disparate impact. But when it comes to running these kinds of promotions, you've got to use tests. And then they went through the enormous level of preparation that the city used in order to secure a test that would be race-free. And they said, look, you can't show that you can do this without tests, and you can't show that these guys didn't try their level best to do it right. And then they said, you guys come up with some alternative situation. And there was no alternative test that was proposed, and the basic argument was that you ignore testing altogether and rely on such things as command presence and subjective evaluation of factors, and the court rejected all of that.
And Justice Kennedy wrote, fear of litigation alone cannot justify an employer's reliance on race to the detriment of individuals who passed the examinations and qualified for promotion. And Rory,
that's
Little,
right. And so essentially what happens is that's the basic framework. And what they said, normally a city is given a power to settle a case without litigation, otherwise the world becomes a crazy place. But under these circumstances, his basic intuition was they didn't settle the case because they deeply believed that the test was invalid. They settled it because they had a political struggle on their hands, and they thought that they had to placate those people, including many prominent citizens in New Haven, who wanted a larger representation of minority fighter fires in a city which is heavily minority. And he said, you can't do that. And so the dissent essentially did 2 points, and I'll just state very quickly. One is Justice Ginsburg stressed the long history of discrimination in a city like New Haven, to which the answer was, that's why we went through this elaborate process. And then what she said is, you know, there were a bunch of flaws in this kind of a test that could have been cured, and they should have tried these other devices. So she was willing to allow the city to settle out for good cause, i.e. in its own honest judgment that it was better to do it, whereas the court clearly put a much higher standard on the city, given the fact that they were selling out not only themselves, but the other fighter fires who had done well on the test.
And Deborah Rohde, where do you think this leaves affirmative action in the United States?
Well, not in a good place. I think many employers are still going to be at risk from liability, no matter what they do. And it's a bit of a no-win situation. And the difference between what's an honest judgment or good cause, the dissenting standard, and what the majority by a splintered 5-4 vote, so, of course, you know, it's going to be up for grabs when the court's composition changes in terms of what it would require before the city abandoned the test, is highly fact-sensitive and open to competing judgments. So even under the standards that the court created, assuming that you think those were the right standards, you're still going to have a lot of factual dispute about the circumstances in which an employer can try to achieve a more balanced workforce.
Rory Little, do you agree with what Deborah Rohde is saying, that this leaves employers in a place where they're damned if they do, damned if they don't? Or does this ruling today say really remove a legal route avenue for those who, say, in this case, the minority firefighters, to sue, to say, hey, this was unfairly administered?
Well, I think it's actually very hard to say where this leaves us. I mean, the first thing is that it is 5-4. All the justices are concerned about Title VII and how it operates, and I think what you're going to see very quickly is a number of legislative responses. And Title VII may not read the same a year from now. Sonia Sotomayor is not going to make any difference here because Justice Souter, of course, is with the dissenters here, and that's who she would replace.
Although it is hard to predict exactly how someone would rule, but obviously this was a case where she was involved and has really expressed how she feels about it.
This is pretty unusual. This one we do know how she would rule. And, of course, this one won't come up to her again, but others will. The other thing is that there's a constitutional set of issues that is lurking here, which Congress really has to deal with as well. So I don't think this invalidates affirmative action. I think it tells employers they've got to be much more careful in selecting the tests that they use, because if their tests aren't going to yield sort of valid results, that is, results that are non-discriminatory, they're going to be in a, you know, you can't win either way situation in some sense. So this will put a greater emphasis on the testing and the development of tests. I mean, there's a lot of other tests they could have used. And as Justice Ginsburg points out, believe it or not, firefighting has a long history of race discrimination. It's been sort of, we hire our cousin and our friends, and we don't hire blacks, we don't hire minorities, we don't hire women. And so this is a profession where if you don't have a test that's valid, you're likely to get the discrimination.
And how far back, do you know how far back this case, the original trial court, do you have any sense? I'm just kind of, because a lot has changed in terms of outreach. I mean, I think of even here in San Francisco. Yeah, Richard Epstein, go ahead.
Justice Ginsburg's dissent sort of goes back to 1972 with a clear implication. All of this stuff can go back a lot further. I don't quite agree with Rory on what this does about testing. It seems to me that what the case does for the first time is actually validate tests, which are carefully used. There's been a very long history in which the first part of the test essentially on disparate impact was persuasive, and the other two steps were essentially always failures. You couldn't get to business necessity, get through that, and if you couldn't get through that, you never had to worry about alternative means. I think, in effect, that the whole system is completely crazy. I've never been a fan of Title VII. I think that whenever you're dealing with employment decisions, you have to have some degree of discretion. And one of the sensible accommodations that was ruled out in a case called Gratz against Bollinger said, look, you know, we have to understand that it's not just this test which has shown a disparate impact. There has never been a test which has not shown some degree of disparate impact that anybody's been able to come up with. We think that participation in minority groups is important. What we'd like to do is to have a setback, and so give a 5-point advantage or something of that sort. That was ruled out of bounds in the earlier cases. And so once you get rid of those kinds of intermediate compromises, what you do is you're left with these damned if you do, damned if you don't situations. And all of corporate law, when trying to face with problems like this, has always relied on a kind of a good faith standard with a little bit of reasonableness overtones. And that's what's missing in these Title VII kinds of cases. So I think, in effect, if you just got rid of the statute, it would be very easy to do so for private employers, most of whom would have some degree of affirmative action programs, and you wouldn't have to have these courts trying to figure out which ones are good or bad. Harder to do that in public circumstances. But I think that two things. One, I think that the conservatives were right on the law. And I think that the law is all wrong and that Justice Ginsburg has a lot of sense when she's trying to move back to sort of give yourself a way to take something into account other than merit. In police departments, it's probably more important than in fire departments. But even with respect
to... Why is that?
Because what happens is, for example, take sex. You do not want to send two men into a house with a domestic violence dispute. You want to have a woman on that team. 90% of the time, if you could possibly do it. And so the community relations part is extremely important. Merit is not just an ability to do tests. Merit also is an ability to relate to the community and to gain trust. And anybody who ever worked in any kind of business knows all of this stuff. The conservatives tend to be blind to it. And the problem with the liberals on this case is it's not that they're talking about what makes sense as a business matter. They just want to beat the horn of past discrimination 45, 50 years ago, when in fact the whole purpose of these tests was to try to cut off from that particular past.
Deborah Rohde, do you agree that this kind of discrimination just doesn't happen anymore?
No, we know it happens, and you know, as Rory said, there's and as the dissenting opinions point out, there's a very long history of discrimination on the basis of gender as well as race in these organizations, despite considerable evidence that in a variety of capacities, members of formerly excluded groups perform as well and in some ways better than those who were admitted under tests that violated the so-called 80-20% rule. I mean, I think it's important to note that the whole literature on testing suggests a great deal of imprecision in trying to design a system that really gets at appropriate job attributes or an educational context, applicants' qualifications. People can legitimately disagree about what the most important qualifications are. And in any kind of job where interacting with the community, for example, as is true in police and firefighting work, is involved, you don't want to just look at scores on pencil and paper tests.
Yeah.
I think you see this clearly in an earlier Supreme Court decision, which involved an affirmative action case, the first one that the court had that involved a gender preference case. And there was actually a Santa Clara County road dispatcher's case in which a white male sued because he got a higher score on a test than a woman who also, he scored higher on a composite, including a written test and interviews, than the woman who was actually promoted in a context in which there were almost no women on the road crews. And the court sort of accepted on its face that the white male was, quote, more qualified. But if you actually looked at the procedure of ranking, although there were numerical scores, they were numerical scores attached to performance on a subjective interview. And so this woman is being interviewed by a couple of men who are openly hostile to having women on the road crews. And the fact that she's scored as close as she did to the white male applicants suggests she was probably more qualified if she'd been able to do that well under circumstances of enormous harassment and stress.
Rory Little, I want to bring you into this conversation. In terms of the scope of this ruling, does this apply really mostly or even entirely to public institutions, or what's the impact on private employers?
You know, I don't know that I'm competent to answer that question. I mean, Title VII, I think, applies to both, but I think probably Deborah and Richard know more about this particular statute. I'm more interested. I don't think the impact of this case is going to be as large as it seems at the end of the term. It's only got such focus because of Sonia Sotomayor, and I really predict that there's going to be legislative responses because you can hear with Deborah and Richard that nobody can really agree as to how to settle these things. The Constitution isn't enough. It's too heavy a club. It's too blunt an instrument. So we're going to have some legislative addressing here.
Richard Epstein, go ahead.
Yeah, Justice Scalia hinted darkly that to the extent that you require people to use disparate impact tests and so forth, that you're running into constitutional difficulties under the Equal Protection Clause. Look, Deborah and I agree on one thing, and I think we ought to get that out, is that when you're trying to run a complex operation, pencil and paper tests don't do all the things that you want to do. My view is that's true when the tests are reliable, as I think they tend to be, or when they're not. It's true when you've had no past history of discrimination, and it's true when you don't. I mean, my point is that this is just simply too tight a straitjacket, and what we've done is gotten ourselves into a very serious problem under Title VII. But there's also something else. There's nothing which says when you look at subjective preferences on various other kinds of issues, it's going to reverse the findings that you're going to get on the written test. Some of the things surely will, like community relations, but command presence may be positively correlated with pencil and paper results and so forth, so you don't know that. It's a very hard problem to deal with, and unless you give local government some degree of discretion, you're not going to get any kind of political legitimacy. I think that's the central point. I would wish that Justice Scalia and so forth would all back off of the norm about a colorblind society. But remember, that was at one time was the liberal chant in 1964. The statute was drafted that way. It was a mistake in 64 in some regards. Mm. And right now we can't survive with the lack of flexibility because the truth is that when this case comes down, it will resonate very harshly with large numbers of people who believe that we have to kind of run our country another way. And I think, generally speaking, we want to put the government under very strict constraints when it limits private discretion on people who handle their own property, but we have to give them more discretion when it turns out how it is that they deal with public matters.
Rory Little, unrelated or sort of a general question, it seems that these big sort of social questions, whether it's abortion, gay rights, gun control, they tend to typically they are released at the end of the term. What's the reason for that?
Well, I mean, let's be both pragmatic and realistic. I mean, some of it has to do with when they're argued. The firefighters' case wasn't argued until the last session. It was only argued 2 months ago, and so it comes at the end of the term. Some of it has to do with how hard it is to decide and when you're going to have a case that raises really big issues and is deeply dividing the justices and often a constitutional case, you're going to have longer periods of time to basically exchange opinions, and that's what they have to do. They all exchange their opinions, and then they respond to each other's opinions. So some cases just take longer because they're harder. You generally see these 5-4s issued on the last day. You don't see unanimous opinions issued on the last day. The unanimous ones come easier. But some was just an accident of calendaring. This was not the most important case of the term by any means. It just happened to be argued last.
And we will talk about some of the other decisions earlier in the year from this Supreme Court with Rory Little, a professor of law at Hastings College of the Law, Richard Epstein, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and Deborah Rohde from Stanford Law School. And we'd love you to join our conversation. Tell us what you think about today's ruling, about the departure of David Souter and the arrival potentially of Sonia Sotomayor. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. 866-733-6786. And as always, you can email us. It's forum@kqed.org. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here this morning and most of this week for Michael Krasny. We're talking this hour about the final day of the U.S. Supreme Court's term and some of the decisions, in particular an affirmative action decision that came down. Our guests, Rory Little, professor of law at Hastings College of the Law. Also with us by phone from Chicago, Richard Epstein, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. And joining us from down the peninsula, Deborah Rohde, director of the Center on the Legal Profession at Stanford's Law School. And we, of course, want to take your phone calls. 866-733-6786 is the number. Let's go first to New York City, and LJ is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning. Good afternoon. Scott, can you hear me?
Yes, go right ahead.
Yes. This was a case, the Richie DiStefano New Haven case, that actually caught my imagination as the somebody who follows these social issue, hot-button, quote-unquote, kind of Supreme Court cases closely. A few months ago, I'm very familiar with sort of the history of discrimination in New Haven, Connecticut. And I think that there's a reason why firefighters and various organizations still to this day, even though Sandra Day O'Connor famously a few years ago, and I think those Michigan cases said, we'll give it 20 years or whatever, we're always going to need something to remedy this, you know, centuries of various biases. But let me just make the very quick crux of my point. Obviously, I'm a supporter of these policies and disappointed with this ruling this morning. But with Sonia Sotomayor on the court, and I hope she is confirmed, I trust she will be.
LJ, I'm going to ask you to get to your question.
Well, all right, I'll get to my ultimate point, and that is that she will be a disappointment, not only certainly to conservatives who won't agree with her on anything, but to liberals.
All right.
She's quite moderate if you look at her record, and I don't think she's going to shake much up.
Okay,
at
well,
all.
Thank you so much for your thoughts. Rory Little, it is hard to predict, as David Souter, better than most, has shown. It is hard to predict on some things, and in his case, many things, how a justice is going to rule. Why is that?
Well, it's hard to predict, you know, for lots of reasons. One thing is that the issues tend to change over time, and you can't predict what it's going to be 20 years from now, what's going to be our most important issue. Another is that sometimes we don't know how someone's background actually affects them on certain issues. I mean, Sonia Sotomayor, people say, is a relatively devout Roman Catholic. How is that going to affect her on the abortion question? Well, you can't say. Justice Brennan was a devout Catholic and was, as you know, very liberal on those questions. You can say one thing, I think, about Sotomayor, which is that she's more socially involved than Justice Souter. It may be the biggest difference because politically they may turn out to be pretty similar. But he's not a guy who walked around the court trying to influence anybody. He's not a guy who went to cocktail parties and tried to suggest to other justices that maybe they see it from his point of view. My sense is that Sotomayor is more social, and she may have a bigger impact on the court because of who she is than what she thinks.
And
Justice Marshall had that effect. You know, I mean, Justice Lewis Powell said, gee, now there's a black guy sitting in the conference room with me, and how can I need to rethink my views. So I think that's going to be the most important part about her.
What about you, Richard Epstein? Do you see much changing?
It's very difficult. Her two most famous opinions are probably her two least impressive efforts. I don't think she had any business punting on this case when it was down in the Second Circuit. It was too important and too difficult an issue to give it the back of the hand treatment. And there was another case on public use where she, again, made a very short opinion. But there are two other features of her background which I think really matter and make her into a less liberal candidate than some might suppose. This woman is a former prosecutor, and she's a former commercial litigator. In a private firm dedicated to dealing with antitrust, intellectual property, sales disputes, and so forth. People like that often turn out to care more about the sort of the private law conceptions, common law rules of property and contract and tort than do people who come out of the public side of the business. So in business matters and in antitrust matters, she may turn out to be fairly centrist, indeed, as most of the court has been on those questions. So I think, in effect, that one of the truly terrible features about the current selection process in the Supreme Court is the abortion issue ranks so high, the affirmative action issue a little bit after that, and maybe now all the stuff having to do with detainees and the like become very important. And 90% of the Supreme Court business is something for which we don't examine, at least publicly, the qualifications of the nominee. As a justice, as a judge, she was pretty good. She was not the best of the people who were possibly available, but there's certainly nothing about her when you look at the entire record which should give rise to hysterical forms of opposition. And my guess is that she will be sort of like Souter. She'll be probably somewhat to the left of center, which is more expectable from a Democratic president than it was from a Republican one.
All right, let's go back to the phones again. The number 866-733-6786, and Tom is on the line in Cupertino. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. I'm now in San Jose.
You're moving.
Yes, I am. You know, I'd like to make two comments that were made earlier on them. One was the man from the Hoover Institution who said that cities are allowed to use something other than the test. Or should I say merit? He actually used the word something other than merit to decide who should get a job. And I'm thinking the only way that we'll ever reach any level of a truly race-neutral, race-blind, I think, is a misnomer, race-neutral society is meritocracy. So when you're saying that, you know, the best for the job are not going to get the job because we've color-coded our society to a point where it's just not palatable to give the best person the job, especially in a position of public safety, I think that we really have to, everyone, look in the mirror and wonder where we've gone as a society. Another point I'd like to make is the woman from Stanford Law School mentioned that men will, these men who are on the oral panel could not give women a fair shake, and I think that is just the most tired, worn-out, threadbare, feminist-hard as a way of basically for furthering their causes. I'm a man. I'm in my 40s. Let me tell you that most men I know in positions where they have to hire people are ultra, ultra sensitive to women and minorities because of the times that we live in. So to drag that out,
Tom, I think you made your major point, and you're fading out a little bit. So we're gonna let you go. But Deborah Rohde, you want to respond?
All men are biased. I said on the facts of that case, the particular man conducting the interview had a history of opposing women in the position for which she was applying, and they refused to issue coveralls to women and referred to women as, in derogatory ways. So, in that case, it's somewhat dated. Certainly,
yeah,
things have changed, and people who have those views wouldn't express them that way right now. But if I could also just weigh in slightly on the Sotomayor point and how much difference she's going to make here, I think it's important. I agree with Richard to look at a record as a whole and all the hoopla that's accompanied one statement she made at Berkeley in a speech has really, I think, obscured the broader record, which is what's relevant in terms of predicting where she'll be on the court. And, you know, in the discrimination cases that have come before her as an appellate court, she's ruled on an 8-1 basis against the plaintiffs. So she's clearly a moderate on these issues. What I think she will bring to the court, though, is a life experience of being on the receiving end of discrimination. And that's relevant. I clerked for Justice Marshall, and it's quite true that, as his colleagues put it on his retirement, that having him on the court, as White put it, reminded us of things we'd rather forget. Mm. And I think having someone who brings the experience of encountering oftentimes subtle biases to these cases is going to make a difference, not just in terms of the single vote that he or she casts, but in the kinds of issues that will inform the whole court's deliberations.
Roy Little, I think a lot of people would agree that most people, perhaps, that our life experiences influence the way we see things, and that's no less true for judges. And yet that is the comment that Sotomayor made when she was speaking here in Berkeley a few years ago that has, you know, gotten her in some hot water, I guess, with conservatives. Why is it that that seemingly matter-of-fact kind of notion that how we live our lives and where we come from affects our thinking and our view of things, why was that so controversial?
Well, the cynic in me says it's controversial because they don't have a lot to work with, and so they're working with that. I mean, has she used one word different? She said, I'd hope that somebody would make a better decision. Had she said, make as good a decision, we would have very little to work with. But, you know, it disturbs people. People believe the law is supposed to be sort of pure and neutral, and that if you put 10 people in a room, they'll all agree what the law means and what the result should be. And it disturbs people to realize that's just not the way it works and that law isn't a whole lot better than making soup. And you don't always want to see what goes into it, and it's going to taste different every time. And I mean, the law is an art. It's not a science. And so the background of judges is important. And if you live in a diverse society, if you live in a society where the controversies brought to the courts are going to be diverse, then life experience actually matters a lot. And as Richard Epstein says, a corporate litigator is going to have a different view than a public defender, a prosecutor. I mean, these things influence our – now, which way they influence is actually impossible to tell. They often say that prosecutors are the people who are hardest on the prosecutors because they've seen it.
Yeah.
So, you know, but it's disturbing to people to understand that, gee, it's not going to be neutral and scientific.
Back to the phones. Again, the number 866-733-6786. Jesus is on the line in Los Altos. Good morning.
Yes, thank you. I have two questions. Number one, everyone keeps talking about it being an employer, but it's really local government. Does the ruling bring into question the legitimacy of that local government if people know that there are potential discriminatory actions? And my second question has to do with what I read in the paper about a year ago, which was that the fire chief was resigning because his son was going to be hired as a fire chief. Of the hundreds and thousands of people that apply, is it right for me to be suspicious that the chief's son makes it to the top and is then hired? I'll take my answers offline.
All right. Richard Epstein, you want to take a stab at that, the credibility of local governments? And
well, I mean, look, it's very clear that Title VII does not discriminate on its face between public and private employers. They're both subject to the same kinds of restrictions. The Constitution surely does, insofar as it imposes much greater restrictions on what governments can do than on what private individuals can do. But I think the key point to understand is that most of the law has gone on the wrong track when it doesn't distinguish between the government as an employer, the government as a manager, and the government as a regulator. And there is no manager in this world who will always be able to come up with the same decision if you give them the same set of facts. There's just too much differences, as Rory said. And so we've always had a kind of a good faith standard there, and I'm willing to sort of live with that, but it's quite clear that that's not the way Title VII is worded today. And the whole question is now trying to bureaucratize the entire system, and that's the source of this immense compliment. Now, I disagree with Deborah on a little bit. I mean, I do think that there are all sorts of differences that are going on. I don't think it's because we've got a lot of sexist men around. I think the last interlocutor who said that most men bend over backwards on these cases is probably closer to the truth today, whatever the situation may have been 30 years ago. But what's so hard about all of this is that when we talk about having different backgrounds, we don't want to let that obscure the following point, which is that I, coming from one background, should be able to understand and internalize something that you from a different background says. We don't want it to be as though we just are always ships passing in the night and that through reasoned deliberation we can't come to something of a consensus. And when one starts to hear that sort of rhetoric coming forward, that it's sort of immutable knowledge that one group possesses that another cannot possibly hope to gain no matter how hard they try, that I get very nervous. And Justice Sotomayor, she hit the raw nerve, not because she said that Latinos had different perspectives, but she said kind of a wise Latino woman would outperform everybody else. I don't take it very seriously as a long-term statement of view. It was an ill-advised remark given at one of these academic conferences where people tend to go a bit over the top. But I do not think that we want to sort of celebrate diversity to the extent that it allows us to ignore the fact that reasoned people working hard, trying to get the right decision, can actually come to an agreement with one another.
But there is also the question of credibility. And Rory Little, as you look at the courts,
and I agree with that.
As you look at the courts in California, which is, of course, a very diverse state, 72% of the judges are white, male, I believe, and there are efforts to change that. But it does, when you're in a courtroom, you're hoping at least that some of the judges and the attorneys may reflect your background, perhaps, and it gives you, I think, more a sense that maybe you're going to get a fair shake.
You know, there's a concept of representative democracy, which is what our Constitution is really based on, and the concept of representative democracy has changed a lot since 1789, when it was all just white males who owned property. I do want to come to Deborah's defense just a little bit here. When the caller says he bends over backwards for women now, I'll say that that's because Title VII has been operating for a long time now, and he's been raised in a corporate enterprise which says you got to be sensitive to these things. That is to say, the law shapes the way we feel, and it may be that without the engine, if you will, of Title VII, and affirmative action programs, you wouldn't have people being sensitive to these things. And I guess I sort of think that nobody can know what it feels like to be a victim of discrimination until they've been a victim of discrimination. I can have someone tell me that all day, but I'm not going to internalize it the way someone who – now, is that a good thing? Should that overwhelm the law? No, it shouldn't. I mean, and Sonia Sotomayor has never said that. She says she'll follow the law. But I do want to say that the credibility of the system in some sense does depend on the faith. When the caller says the son of the fire chief is going to be a new chief and should I be suspicious, gee, I don't know. But the fact that he has that question makes you realize that people have a perception issue with their government, and the judiciary is part of the government.
And Richard Epstein, fire departments, and to a lesser extent, I think, police departments have been particularly insular.
And they certainly have been, and I think they've some recognition they're trying to overcome this. But again, I want to be careful about the subjectivity. If nobody knows what it's like to be the victim of a discrimination until discriminated against, no one knows what it's like to be the victim of reverse discrimination until you've been discriminated against reversely. Yes, I'm suspicious, but this is the sad truth. Probably the son of a fire chief has much more exposure to how that business works than anybody else, and you would expect him on average to do better just the way it's much more likely that any person who's the kid of a professional baseball player is going to become a professional baseball player relative to somebody picked at random in the population.
Yeah, although baseball really is much more of a meritocracy,
I think you could say. You and I don't know how these businesses actually run, and one of the things that's so hard about being a lawyer is we make rules for everybody on the face of the globe when we have very little direct hands-on experience with most of the businesses that we have to regulate.
Rory Little, this, of course, was not the most important ruling of the year. Looking back at the last few months, so what else stands out for you in terms of we had a voting rights case decided just last week. There was something on DNA evidence and whether or not there's a constitutional right to get a DNA test if you're convicted of a crime. How would you characterize this term?
Well, I mean, how do you characterize this term? It's always hard to say that until you've had a perspective to look it all over. But there certainly were a lot of big decisions. As usual, Justice Kennedy turns out to be in the middle. And what will be interesting is whether Sotomayor changes that dynamic at all. It doesn't look like she will necessarily, but you never know. You had this strip search case, which says you just can't strip search a 13-year-old child based on a very little bit of suspicion. You have the voting rights case where they dodged the bullet and did not declare the Voting Rights Act unconstitutional, but suggested that it might be. Yes, you have this case that says a prisoner has no constitutional right to get the DNA evidence, even if he'll pay for it himself, to have it tested. Again, in the context of someone who doesn't look like he's innocent. But you do wonder, 5-4, what's the excuse for not giving the evidence? You have this judicial disqualification case from West Virginia where the Supreme Court actually said a Supreme Court justice of the state should have recused on its facts. That's a very interesting case. It's going to have a lot of repercussions. You had some overruling, actually, of a very important Sixth Amendment case, which has to do with, confessions and interrogations. And
is there, as you look at those, and I realize you haven't sat down to analyze the whole thing, but does it seem that the Roberts Court is clearly moving in a direction on these questions, or are they just too disparate to really tie together?
Yeah, well, I have to say I have a bias here. I call it the Stevens Court. Now, I worked for Justice Stevens for a while, so I love him, but Justice Stevens is keeping the Roberts Court in check in some sense. The Roberts Court, and I think this is due to Chief Justice Roberts as well. Chief Justice Roberts has taken a very clear position that he prefers a limited result to a reaching result. He would rather not decide the big question if he can decide the smaller question. He says he wants consensus. Now, getting consensus on this ideological court is hard to imagine, but he tries. That combined with Justice Stevens really keeping them honest, I think, on the liberal side and using his assignment power very effectively. What I would say is we have a court that is relatively moderate in its politics and moderate in its results, which is why you get so many concurring opinions or dissenting opinions from Justices Scalia and Thomas, because they're just not happy that it isn't
moving
farther.
They want a more sweeping decision.
Yeah.
All right. Again, Deborah Rohde, go ahead.
Yeah, quickly. You know, Linda Greenberg, the former Greenhouse, the former New York Times reporter for the court, did an interesting compilation when she was speaking just this past couple days at the Fourth Circuit conference, and she tallied up the votes so far, and she said, you know, collectively, this tells you where the court is, that of the conservative justices, they issued 50 dissents, and the liberal justices issued about twice that many, 92 dissents. And as she pointed out, also what was extremely striking about the count, suggesting, of course, that the conservatives got what they wanted about twice as often on the cases where you could discern some kind of political cast. Justice Kennedy cast only 4 dissenting votes. So he really is occupying a critical swing vote, and 21 of those cases were 5-4 decisions, and in most of those, he was the one who was in the middle.
Yeah, Rory Little. You know, there's even talk among attorneys who appear before this court that they craft their arguments directly for Justice Kennedy. Is that a healthy thing?
Well, I don't know. You're always in a tough case. You're always going to have a 5-4 possibility, and so you're going to pitch at the justice who's in the middle. It's probably not healthy to have one justice always playing that role, but it's hard to imagine how a number of appointments could change that unless one of the conservatives were to resign and the Democratic president were to appoint a more liberal person. But you're always going to have a central person that you're arguing to. I think what's really been remarkable, though, is how often some litigants have been able to succeed in arguing to Justice Scalia, for example, in the Confrontation Clause context, for example. They argued to Justice Scalia that the Constitution in 1789 required this, this, and this, and he bought it. And he's out there, Scalia, Thomas, and Stevens and Souter and Ginsburg are out there ruling in favor of criminal defendants now on the Confrontation Clause. So sometimes the pitch ought to be, let's see if we can move around the moderates and bring one of these radicals into our camp.
And it seems like that may be the strategy when we're getting a little afield here. But this gay marriage case that was filed by David Boies and Ted Olson, where they seem to think that they have the votes to overturn DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, that one will be played out at the lower courts first. But it's a risky strategy, I think.
It is a risky strategy. And there are a lot of people who wonder if they're pushing too fast. But I actually think it's a great strategy. I think this is an issue that is going to be ripe. Interestingly, in our society, we ask the courts to resolve these issues, which are hugely social, and that's too bad, I think. But this is an issue that's ripe to be pushed.
All right. Ken in Sacramento has a question. He wrote, I've heard no discussion of how paper and pencil tests are designed in a manner that could be considered discriminatory. The issue has been raised in other contexts. For example, high school exit exams. Can anyone on the panel cite an example of a biased question and a similar question more carefully constructed? How might those questions be worded to be gender or race neutral? Anybody want to take
well,
that
actually,
one up?
It's
Richard
Epstein. Extremely difficult to find these questions today because all the obvious ones based on gender, race, nationality, and so forth have been ruled out from underneath the test. And even if you found a question that did meet those particular criteria, you would still have the odd point that the gaps between the groups by race are much larger than a single or double question would go. I think it is fair to say, and it's a rather somber fact that we have to address as a nation, that nobody has ever been able to design a set of tests that are predictive of relative performance which don't have a racial skew associated with them.
And
it's never been done anywhere by anybody, whether it's the intelligence test, whether it's the College Board's test, whether it's various kinds of occupational tests. And in fact, what we do know is that the very job-specific tests are actually less reliable as a long-term predictor than the general test that used to be used, because what happens is if you test for a single particular element, the moment the person is promoted or moved laterally, the test is no longer any valid, whereas the other tests that work on broader concepts do well. I think the decline of testing has had some very material adverse effects on the entire operation of the system, which is why it is that you want to revisit the Teal case, which said when you have an affirmative action program, you still apply the disparate impact language. I would say if you're running an affirmative action program, you don't have to worry about disparate impact. You already have made sure in a very powerful way that there's no covert smokescreen type issues that you have to face. But If the answer is whether or not these tests are bogus in some deeply flawed sense, I think the answer overwhelmingly, without question, is no. The tests are about as good as human intelligence can make them. And I would say as follows. Anybody who believes that they're bad should come forward at this particular point and design one that's good. And I don't believe there's a person on the planet who can do that.
Rory Little, it seems that this question, though, in the affirmative action ruling, it kind of gets to the heart of the problem that people have with affirmative action, which is that people who are more qualified, at least according to a test, are passed over and in favor of someone just to sort of bring them up the ladder, whether or not they are, quote-unquote, deserving of that based on that test. It really goes to the heart of what rankles people about affirmative action.
Well, I mean, and that's what makes it so hard to swallow. I mean, it depends on your ultimate goal. If this firefighter's case, for example, blacks and whites passed the test. So all these people were judged to be competent to be firefighters. Then the question is, well, who are you going to promote into a very limited number of supervisory positions? One way to do it is to say we'll take the top scores. Well, that way of doing it yielded nothing but white supervisors. Another way to do it would be to say we'll just take, one African-American, one Latino, one white. They're all qualified. Let's move them up. You have to somehow culturally decide you're going to accept that. That we're going to actually pick based on race. And that's what this court says the Constitution forbids. You can't they held that New Haven had disregarded the test results because of race and for no other reason. Justice Ginsburg says, well, they should have disregarded because the tests were lousy. The majority doesn't buy that.
Well, presumably, you have some captains and lieutenants now who are in place in New Haven. What would happen to them? What happens to their promotion and their status? Do you know?
Well, I just have no idea what the status is in New Haven. But I do know this: that it's something like 9% of the supervisors in the fire department there are African American or Latino. That's a very low number compared to even the population. Then you have this question, should it reflect the population or should it be even? Should it be 50-50, even if the African American population is only 20%? So you get into these very difficult questions. What happens? I would imagine that anybody who's in place now doesn't lose their position. But you might have some remedial effort to fill more supervisory spots with more minorities down the line. And New Haven is really going to have to struggle on this one.
Exactly. Well, and I'm sure it's a little uncomfortable for those in the fire department in that city as well, perhaps a little controversial. They just want to fight fires, not political fires. All right. Rory Little, professor of law at Hastings College of the Law, thanks so much for joining us this hour. Thanks also to Richard Epstein, joining us from Chicago. He's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. Deborah Rohde, director of the Center on the Legal Profession at Stanford University. Thanks to all of you. And thanks earlier in the hour as well to Lawrence Hurley from the Daily Journal. I'm Scott Schaefer, and Forum is produced by Tina Lauerberg, Judy Campbell, and Kevin Guillory. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman. And as I said, I'm Scott Schaefer, in for Michael Krasny. Thanks for listening. And stick around. Next hour, we'll be talking about the history, 40-year history of KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.